My name's Stan Malonis, and I am an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome the newcomers or anybody who's new to Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a clause in there I read about people coming to AA to learn how it works. I've been here a while. I still haven't figured it out. A bunch of self-centered people, and that's our disease, talking about each other helps one another. I never can understand that. I heard a guy say one time, I know they cut the 10-minute speaker out because it was running a little late, and I found out that people will walk out on you in AA. There was this this guy talked for 2 hours, and everybody got up and left except the guy in the front row. And so when he got done talking, he went up and he ran down there and he shook the guy's hand. He goes, I really want to know why you stayed here. He says, well, I'm the next speaker. And we went to a retreat this year, and we were at the retreat, and there was a guy named Gavin that was going to come and be our retreat master. And on the way there, he thought he had a heart attack, so he stopped off in the hospital, and he never made it to the retreat. And the nurses were going, well, aren't you worried that they're not going to be able to get along without you out there? He said, everybody out there wants to give a retreat. He said, there will be no problem out there. And are there any Al-Anons here tonight? I knew there was. I could feel them in here. I went to Al-Anon for about 5 years, and I met somebody there and got what I wanted and left, and I've only gone back periodically since. And I've dated women in AA, and I've dated women in Al-Anon, and they seem to be a little different in my perspective. I remember giving the girl in Al-Anon a dozen roses, and she got real suspicious and wondered what I was up to. And I give the girl in AA a dozen roses, and she wanted to know where the jewelry and the chocolates were. And I'm really glad to be here tonight. I was a little apprehensive to be here because there's so many people here that know me, and I'd rather speak to strangers usually. But I don't know. I grew up in a house that was very violent. We were very angry people. Beat on each other, dad beat mom, all that stuff, but that has nothing to do with my alcoholism. That's no more has to do with my alcoholism than it would if I had cancer. It has nothing to do, it's irrelevant, and it's just where I come from. And I remember when I was a little kid, the very first recollection I have of really, really having this disease is when my mother, when I was about 5 or 6 years old, made me take a bath. And I said, I'm not taking a bath. She said, oh yeah, you are. So she forced me into the bathroom, and she made me sit in the tub, and she made me bath. And as soon as I got out of that bathtub, my feet hit the floor. I ran straight out the door. I went to the biggest dirt pile I could find and threw dirt all over myself. I'll show you, I'll hurt me. And I was that way. If you love me, I always thought that by hurting me, it would hurt you. I never got the connection that it was hurting me, and it didn't really hurt other people. I just always figured that's the way it was. And I don't know, my dad sat me down when I was 12 years old, and he said, son, do whatever you want to do, just don't get in any trouble. And everything I did got me in trouble. Every time I turned around, I was in trouble. I was in school, and I got in a lot of trouble in school. And I remember when I was in the fifth grade, a teacher told me that I had to go home. I couldn't stay there because I couldn't sit still in my desk. I just couldn't sit still. She says, you have to get him on some kind of drugs or do something with him in order for him to stay here. If they'd have diagnosed me now, they probably would have got me with attention deficit. I still have a hard time focusing on anything because my mind is so busy all the time. And when I got sober, I looked back on it and I thought, well, maybe I was that way because I wanted attention and I really craved it, and maybe I wasn't getting it home like I thought. But after I've been sober a while, I look back on it now and I realize that what was really wrong with me is, how do you sit still in a desk with all this going on inside of you? All these emotions and all this insanity in my head, and just, I got so much stuff going on inside me, I can't sit in a desk long enough to listen to anything. So I'm always up out of my desk going around. I believe that I've always had alcoholism. I really believe that with everything in me, and maybe people think that when they drank, they got that way. I think I was a freeze-dried alcoholic. You know, I just automatically got that way. You know, I listened to the last month's speaker, and I really liked Keith, and I really wanted to be that kind of person, you know, that had guns and knives and baseball bats and was real volatile and real violent. And I really thought that I'd become that way. And then when I got sober and looked back on it, it's amazing how your perspective changes. I realize now all I really ever was a public nuisance. I mean, you know, But I remember the first time I drank peppermint schnapps and ate cinnamon rolls, and I got sick. I mean, I was sick all night long. And after that night, I swore I'd never eat cinnamon rolls again. But truthfully, I never drank peppermint schnapps again either. But I started drinking on the weekends to fit, and I started doing things like that. And I remember the first time that I really started drinking every day was when I was about 18 years old. And not that at that time I hadn't gotten drunk a lot. I had been drunk a lot, and I'd been really drunk a lot. And I just, at that time in my life, I got into a relationship. It was the first time I'd ever been in a relationship in my life. I was too busy hanging out with the guys. When you're hanging out with the guys, you can't be in a relationship because they might do something and you'll miss it. And if you're with her, I always wanted to be in the action. I always wanted to be with the guys hanging out on the street corner, doing all the things that guys do. And when I got in this relationship, all this stuff started happening to me that I really didn't know how to handle. I had these feelings of inadequacy and the feelings of not enough, and I was just really insecure, and I just couldn't stand it. I remember going over to a friend's house that day, and I started drinking, and all that stuff quieted down inside of me, and I could eat, and I could sleep, and I thought, this is it. I'm going to make a new leaf on life. This is something I'm going to do every day. And I started doing it every day. I started doing it when I woke up in the morning. I started doing it when I went to bed. And there was times when I thought I could quit. I remember there was one time I was getting ready to go out, and she was sitting there, and before we got married, and she started crying. She says, please don't do that tonight. Please, please just stay. Don't do anything like that. And I says, you know what, honey? If you just let me do this tonight, I don't care what happens. I'll do it tonight, and tomorrow I'll make a new leaf. I won't do it anymore. If you just don't nag me tonight, and don't get on my back about it, I'll do that. And I really meant that. If you'd have gave me a lie detector test, I think it would have told you I was telling the truth. And the next thing I know is I'm driving home and I'm throwing everything out the window. The drugs, the alcohol, all the paraphernalia. I get home, I go to sleep. I wake up the next day and I think, oh shit, I got to go back and get all that stuff again. What am I doing? I must have had a moment of insanity last night. No. And I'd been that way a lot in my life. I remember when we got married, I said, if you just let me do it today, when we got married, they had to nudge me. I just kept nodding out, and they'd nudge me, and I'd wake up, and I made a new leaf then. And on our honeymoon, I went up in the mountains in Wyoming. I went way up in the mountains as far as I could get, and I went up there, and I just, after about a day or two, I just couldn't stand it. I just felt like I was going to go crazy. And I remember I kept my truck full throttle back to town to get something to drink, and just to shut off everything that's inside of me. And there's a lot of times I really wanted to quit in my life, and I just couldn't. It kind of reminds me of that story about Johnny. There's this guy named Johnny, and he's in a mental institution. And they said, Johnny, when you get out of here, what are you going to do? He said, when I get out of here, I'm going to go get a slingshot and some rocks, and I'm going to come back here and break all the windows in this place. And they said, well, Johnny, with that kind of attitude, you can't leave here. So 6 months go by, and Johnny comes back up to him again. And they said, Johnny, when you get out of here, what are you going to do? He said, when I get out of here, I'm going to go get a slingshot and some rocks, and I'm going to come back here and break all the windows in this place. And I said, well, that's really good, Johnny. You can't leave. 6 more months go by, and Johnny's been back there talking to the guys, and he goes back up to the board, and they said, Johnny, when you get out of here, what are you going to do? He said, when I get out of here, he said, I'm going to get a job. And they said, well, that's really good, Johnny. What are you going to do then? He said, I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to find a girlfriend. They said, well, that's good. What are you going to do with her? He said, I'm going to take her on the highest mountain that I can find. They said, what are you going to do with her there? He said, I'm going to have sex with her. They said, how are you going to go about doing that? He says, well, I'm going to kiss her. I'm going to unbutton her blouse. I'm going to take off her bra. I'm going to take the elastic out of her bra. I'm going to go get some rocks and come back here and break all the windows in this place. I always identify with Johnny because no matter what I do, I always come back to throwing the rocks. I can't ever get away from it. I don't know why I keep throwing the rocks. And I remember her and I got a divorce, and during the divorce process, I had to go see this psychologist, and I'd go up and see this psychologist. And I remember one day my subsistence check came because I wasn't working at the time until I got straightened out. And I knew I couldn't go to the bar first. I had to go to her office, and I went to their office, and I sat down, and she goes, okay. She says, in order for me to help you, you need to start being honest with me. I said, what do you want? She says, I want you to start telling me the truth. She said, what are you going to do today? I'm like a cat on a hot tin roof. I said, well, I'm going to go get drunk as soon as I get out of this office. She said, well, with that kind of attitude, I can't give you your job back. And with that kind of attitude, I can't help you. I was like, well, I got to leave then. And I left. And on the way to the bar, I didn't feel too bad. But I remember after the first couple drinks, I thought about it. Them little inventories that I would take in moments like that, and after everything inside me settled down, and I think, well, why do I have to keep doing this? Other people don't have to do this. I had friends that drank as much as I did or more. Why can't I stop? what I really wanted in my life was I really wanted the lifestyle that I have now and be able to drink and use drugs like I used to. That's what I really wanted. And I could never achieve that. I watched other people that seemed to maintain a lifestyle and seemed to be able to drink and use drugs too. And I wanted that too. But their life seemed to stay okay. My life always seemed to keep getting worse and worse and worse. And I never could understand it. And after that divorce, it didn't take me long to hook up with somebody else. I was in a bar, and she was not even old enough to be there. She was running away from home. She had no luggage. She had nothing. That's my kind of gal. Let's hook up, you know. And we got together, and we hung out for a while. And this is my period. I went 12 years without drinking. I was on methadone maintenance for 12 years, but I didn't drink the whole time I was on it. I hooked up with her, and I decided I needed to make a new leaf on life, so I moved to Salt Lake, and I started doing that methadone every day so I could go to work every day, and I started working, and eventually what happens always happens. After about 10 or 12 years, it just quits working. I physically can't work anymore. I gotta start drinking, I gotta start popping pills, and I gotta start doing other stuff because what I'm doing isn't working for me anymore, and I'm doing massive amounts of stuff. And her dad got me a really good job, and we had a little boy. He was 2 years old, and I really wanted to be a good father, and I really wanted to make things work, and I tried everything in me to do that. And I really thought at times I was doing okay, and I found out later that I really wasn't, but I really wanted to. It's kind of like there's been times in my life when there's a part of me that really, there's this person that I really want to be, but yet deep down in my heart I know what kind of person I really am. And it's like the person that I really am can never be the person that I really want to be. It's just too far of a stretch. And there was times when it came time for him to have diapers or to get fed, and I'd spend the money on booze. And I always felt really a lot of shame for that, and I felt really bad for doing that, but that's part of the deal. You know, the part I hated was, in the beginning of my drinking, the prices were real high. I mean, you'd lose a wife, and you lose a job, but that's part of doing the deal. I didn't mind that as much as I minded the end. When you're losing jobs, you're losing wives, you're losing families, and the effect is way down. That's what I hated. As long as I'm getting the effect out of alcohol, I don't care what I lose. I don't care if you put me in a drainage ditch for the rest of my life. I'm willing to do that in order to change the way I feel enough so I fit in life to live there. But what I hated was the end. I hated when it just wouldn't work like it used to. It wouldn't cover up the shame and the guilt and the remorse that I had in it. And I felt so disconnected from life, and I felt just so insecure. There was times in the end when I wouldn't even go out unless it was at night. I was so afraid. I remember the last detox I went into before I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Her dad got me this really good job and working on out on missiles and stuff, and I'm doing that. And they'd come to me one day, and they said, you know, you got to clean up. So I said, okay. I physically couldn't work anymore. I was getting to the point where I just couldn't work anyway. So I decided, well, that's probably a good idea. I think I will. So I went home, and they gave me 2 weeks to do it in. And I stayed home for like 13 days, you know, before I did anything. And her dad comes to the door the 13th day and says, you know what, you got to do something today, or we're going to have to, you got to go to detox today. And I'm supporting the family, wasn't very much, but I was the only one doing that. And I thought about it for a minute. I went in the bathroom. I found all the drugs I had in there. I took everything I had, everything I had. I sat there for about 30, 40 minutes, waited for it to take effect, walked out in the front room and says, I'll go anywhere you want. Let's go to detox. So I went into detox. I was so loaded in detox that I went to an AA meeting. I didn't hear nothing. I didn't even know I was in an AA meeting until years later. I slept through the whole thing. The next morning I got up and I told the doctor what I wanted to detox. I said, these are certain items that I have to have in order for me to get clean. And him and I argued for a while, and he decided he wasn't going to give me them things. And I decided that if I couldn't have the things that I needed to get clean, then I wasn't going to clean up. But what really was going on was I had tried a lot of times in my life to quit drinking, and I knew that I wasn't going to be able to quit doing it. I knew it. I knew that I didn't have what it takes to do it. And I started leaving that day. I was crying, and I called my whole family and told them how wrongly I'd been treated in this place and how they wouldn't give me what I really needed. And I walked out the door, and she's standing there with our little boy, and she says, if you drink or use drugs again, we're leaving. Oh, well, leave the car, because that's where I'm going right now. And 2 weeks later, I take her to detox. We about kill each other going to detox. I get her into detox, and I'm feeling bad. I'm that kind of person. I do that to somebody. I treat them really bad, and then I feel really bad, so I do a lot of nice things for them. So I was feeling really bad for the way I treated her before she went to detox, so I took her down some flowers, and I thought I was really being a good guy. And she got out of detox. She came to our house with two police officers, her mom and dad, and her new boyfriend from detox, and moved out. I thought that was the worst day of my life. If you'd have came and asked me, is this the worst day of your life? I'd have said, yeah, that's the worst day of my life, man. That was one of the best days of my life. I just didn't know it. Anyway, I didn't think I was going to survive that. I'm coming to the end of the alcoholism, and I can't work. I have nothing left. She's leaving. He's leaving. Everything I really want in my life's leaving. And I went to Salt Lake, and I started staying in flop houses, and I just couldn't stand the pain. It was just too much. I wanted out. I didn't have enough guts to go out, but I wanted out. So the only way I knew to do it was quit eating. I quit eating. I started staying in these flop houses. I'd take as much drugs and alcohol as I could possibly get into myself, and I'd sleep as much as I possibly could. I remember I used to have guys come to my room and ask me, you want something to eat? And these, you know, these guys are religious people. Let us give you something to eat. I don't want nothing. I just want to die. And all I want to do is sleep. That's the only relief I could get. Because I'd wake up every day in the consciousness of the person I hated the most, and that's me. I hated myself. I hated life. I was afraid. I couldn't stand it. And through a set of circumstances, in all this mist, my dad had got a divorce and came down, and he got me out of there, and we started living together. And I got on Social Security, and I'd sit home every day and watch cartoons and drink and use drugs and watch cartoons and drink and use drugs. I did that day in and day out for a long time. And but at least it was better than what I was doing. I was just sleeping every day, so I did that, and him and I fought a lot. I don't know how anybody could be around me then, because at that time, alcohol was getting to the point where it wasn't doing for me what it used to do for me. It wouldn't cover up the anger and the fear anymore. And I got real, when I get like that, I get real crazy. And I'm just existing. And that's what I always related to Janis Joplin. She said she never liked to smoke pot because it made her think too much. You know, I wanted everything in here to shut off. I just didn't want to be awake. I didn't want to be conscious. I hated it. And we lived together, and we left there, and we went to Denver, Colorado, and in Denver we moved from there to here. And he's the only person in the world that would have anything to do with me anymore. The only person. And my dad always loved me. And he always said he didn't know what he'd do if I died, but he stuck with me through all that, and I wouldn't have never done what he did. And I've gone to Al-Anon, and there's a lot of people in Al-Anon who wouldn't have done that either. And I don't know. We came here, and I'll never forget. We were living together, and I was on a run, and I had his ATM card, and I had his number. And I started taking money out of his bank account. This is the only person to have anything to do with me anymore. And I remember when I went to steal that card from him, I lived in the same house as him. I have no idea to this day why I did that, but I didn't go through the front door to take the card. I snuck through the goddamn window, just like a thief would, right? And I went and I took the card, and I'll never forget how shameful I felt that night. God, I hated that. I just really hated myself. And I went on a 4 or 5 day run, and I just kept taking as much money out of there every day that I could. And finally, I realized, like I always do, that the party's over with, man. I got to do something. And what do I do when that happens? I go to detox, you know? But I'd been to so many detoxes that I'm the kind of person, you don't have to hit me in the head with a 2x4. After a while, I realized I'm not going to be able to quit drinking. And I went into detox, and I had a little bit of money in my pocket. I said, will you take me? And they said, oh, yeah, we'll take you. I said, hold that thought. I'll be right back. I still had a little bit of money left. I mean, if this is really going to be my last time, I mean, really. I mean, I really got to spend this money that I got. I didn't go there planned, like you got to have cigarettes while you're there and all that stuff. I just went out there and did that, and I went into detox. And when I went into detox, I was sitting there, and I was real fortunate. I got a doctor in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he says, we're going to take you off everything. Huh? Wait a minute, that's a little drastic, isn't it? I mean, get me off the cocaine and the alcohol, and leave me on the Valium and the antidepressants that I'm on. You know, I mean, after all, you got to have something. And he said, I'm taking you off everything. I said, I'm going to tell you something. if you take me off everything, I have seizures, so you can't take me off everything. He said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll give you something for them seizures. I said, okay. So the pills that he gave me, I threw in the garbage can. I'll show you. I'll have a seizure. Then you'll see, change your mind about what's really going on here and give me what I want. Well, after a couple days, I was out on the pavement flopping around like a fish. And I wake up and they're sticking needles in my arm to take blood work. And I had a seizure, and I realized that when I come to. See, I never minded seizures. This might sound sick, but it's true. I never minded seizures. I never minded them because there's a brief moment when there's a period of relief. And every time that I had one, I was detoxing and I was really in a lot of pain. So then 5 or 10 minutes, I always enjoyed because there was relief there. I mean, that's what I've always done my whole life. It's not that I set out in my life to be a masochist or to hurt myself. It's just that I so desperately need to change the way I feel that I'll do anything to do it. Anything. I remember when I was a little kid, I found out if you spun yourself around enough, it changed the way you feel. I did it so much, it makes me so sick that I can't spin around in any form or shape today. I just can't spin around. It makes me too sick. And I didn't mind the seizures because I had a moment of relief, because I've always just wanted to change the way I feel. And while I'm sitting in this treatment center, people are talking and they're running for stuff and they're helping out, and all I can do is just sit there and fry. I felt like somebody hooked me up to 220 volts and I'm just frying, man. And I got really afraid and I left the detox. I only had 18 days. That's all that Medicare would pay for. And when I left detox, I was terrified. And I went to the counselors there and they just, oh, well, that's probably good. I went to somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous and they says, well, you know what? Your head lies to you and it wants to kill you. You should be afraid. And I was really afraid that I would walk right out of that place and go right into a bar or go right into someplace. I was terrified of that, because why would it be any different? My head's drug me around all my life. And now you guys are telling me it lies to me. I really believed it because I started listening to it. And I got out of there and I went to my sponsor who I got in there, and I asked him, I says, well, what should I do? He says, the very first thing you need to do is go to an AA meeting the day you get out of here. The day you get out of here. I said, okay, I will. And I went to an AA meeting, and I went to another AA meeting, and I started going to 5 AA meetings a day. And I'm just going to meeting after meeting, and I'm just hanging out in AA, and I'm just, after about a month of that, my sponsor looked at me and he goes, you have so much desperation in you. I said, I'm so afraid that Alcoholics Anonymous won't work for me. I'm terrified that I'm going to have to go back and live the life that I just came out of, and I don't want to live there anymore. You know, I very rarely talk about this, and when I got out of that place, I was so afraid, I got on, they gave me some antidepressants, and they gave me some stuff for the seizures. And I got out of there and I'm going to AA meetings, and after a while it's like, I'm crazy. I'm tired of taking pills. I'm tired of taking drugs. I'm tired of drinking. I'm just tired of it all. So I got this guy named Joe B, who used to go to How It Works, and I asked him to come outside, and I said, Joe, I don't know what to do. What should I do here? He says, quit taking it all. I said, okay. And I went to my sponsor and he says, why don't you go to a doctor first? I said, okay. So I went to the doctor who I have still today, who's a family doctor, and I went to him and I said, what should I do? He says, you can quit taking the antidepressants, but you got to keep taking, no, he says, keep taking the stuff for your seizures and quit taking the antidepressants. So I went to the doctor that I was in the hospital with, and he told me the complete opposite. So then I got really screwed up. So one morning I woke up, and I took everything that I had, all the pills, everything. I took them over to the toilet. I threw them all in the toilet and flushed the toilet. And I went out of the house, and I was going to the 7 a.m. Thai Club morning meeting. And I walked up there, and I had a feeling come over me I never had come over me before. It came at a gut level. I thought either Alcoholics Anonymous is everything or it's nothing. And I'm tired. Either I'm going to get off all this stuff, or, you know, it's kind of like, it's like this, God. Either get me sober or let me die. Because I'm tired, man. I'm wore out. I'm just wore completely out. And I went up to that meeting that day, and I'll tell you, I felt like I was going to fly apart. And I'm sitting there in a chair, and I'm trying everything I can to sit there. And a guy from Alcoholics Anonymous comes to me and goes, you didn't quit taking them pills, did you? And I said, yeah. He says, you know, when you do, you go crazy. I thought, no shit, you know. I'm already crazy. What does it matter? I mean, it don't matter how much more crazier I get. So every day after that, I would pray in the morning and ask God to keep me clean and sober, but I'd also thank him at night. But during the day, I wasn't praying for God to keep me clean and sober. during the day, when I got down on my knees in places where nobody was watching me, it was to ask God to please shut off my mind, to please shut off the shit. It just keeps running the same thing over and over and over again. Just please shut it off, please. I can't take it. And I get brief moments every time I'd go to an AA meeting. I'm about 90 days sober. I'm in my home group, and this guy's talking about his four-step. He says that my sponsor and I went to California and did a four-step. And I thought, God, I wish somebody would do that with me, you know? I'm going to 5 meetings a day. I'm doing all this stuff. Go to California. Next thing I know, this guy I'm hanging out with comes up to me and goes, grab a piece of paper and a pencil. We'll go to California. He had to go see his son down there, so we drove down there. And I wrote down all my resentments. And I remember at that time, I was driving around with my sponsor too, and he goes, you know, we should be fully self-supporting through our own contributions. You know, well, okay. So I went to a meeting at 7 o'clock in the morning that morning, and I heard somebody announce there was a job at Lake Mead and Las Vegas Boulevard in a 7-Eleven. Now, I've had a lot of good jobs in my life, but I didn't say to myself, well, that job's beneath me. I did what the people in Alcoholics Anonymous told me to do. Do what's in front of you. I went down, I walked down to 7-Eleven, I fill out an application. It's hard to fill out an application when you haven't filled one out for 5 or 6 years. I haven't had a job in that long. What do you put on the application? Self-employed? The way I looked, they wouldn't hire me. And I really didn't think they would hire me. I really didn't. I thought that I was beyond being able to work. And I went down to that 7-Eleven, and I went down and got a sheriff's card, and they hired me for $4.25 an hour. I was making more on Social Security. This made no sense to me at all. So I went ahead and I went there, and then my sponsor says, not only do you go to work there, but you need to go to work there with the attitude that you're needed and to be of service. So I'd go there every night, man. I was working graveyard. I felt like I had to go to work with a M16 and a riot helmet to go down there to go to work. And I'd go down there and I'd start working. But once I got down there, I felt kind of at home because that's where I'd been all my life, on the streets. And I'm sitting there working, and I was thinking of an incident that happened there today, and how self-centered I really am. And there's a guy sitting there when I was new, and he was getting ready to have a seizure. And I says, don't let him have this in this place. Get him out of here first, you know? I don't want to clean up after him. And I don't know if I'd still be that way today or not, but I know that I went to that job and I did the best I could. And after 2 months, I got another job, and I've been at the same job ever since. And I still try to go to work and be of service to my employer. Because every time I go to work and try to do something different, I get screwed up. Every time I go to work and think, well, what are they going to do for me, and what should I be getting, and look what I'm doing, and look what they're doing, and I'm doing more than they are. Every time that I do that, I just end up having a miserable day. So eventually I just got to a point to where I just go to work and I try to do the best job I can and be of service as much as to my employer as I can. And my job has continually gotten better. But I went to California and I wrote that four step, and I wrote it out. And I tell you, I never realized doing something would be one of the most important things that I've done in my whole entire life. I did the fourth step, and I got back with my sponsor, and I started doing a fifth step, and I started going through the stuff. And the thing that reminds me the most of doing this is that I heard a guy at a retreat one time talk about he wanted to be a psychologist. So what he did was, as he went and he studied with this guy that was real intuitive about people. He really understood people, and he went and they waited on 3 people that day, a woman and 2 men. And when they got done, he took him in the back room and he said, I want to talk to you. He said, I want you to tell me what was wrong with these people. And he said he went in this psychoanalytical mode and he was going to start psychoanalyzing each person. And he started to do that, and the guy goes, no, 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 wait a minute. He goes, what's wrong with one of these people is what's wrong with all 3 of these people. And he goes, well, what's that? He said, people that argue with the truth get sick. And my whole life, I've done nothing but argue with the truth. And in the fourth and fifth step, what happened in that process was, when it asked you, perhaps people who harmed us were perhaps spiritually sick as us, can I see myself doing what other people have done that I resented? I remember I had a resentment against a guy that I grew up with for 10 or 15 years. And my sponsor, we finally had a... I was so resentful towards him, and my sponsor asked me, well, could you have done what he did? I says, no, I couldn't have done that. He goes, let's get rigorously honest. Could you have done what he did? I says, you know what? I could have done the exact same thing that he did. And once I was able to start letting people off the hook and understanding that I am like them, that I am capable of doing what anybody else is capable of doing, once I did that and could look at myself and understand where I've been selfish and dishonest and self-seeking all my life, and where have I been frightened, and where have I set the ball rolling, and all the questions that they ask you in there, It was the beginning of me being able to be allowed to be able to have relationships with people again. Because as long as they're the problem, I could never have relationships with anybody because I was always in conflict with them. Because I could never understand all the things that was going on with me. Bill talks about in 12 and 12 is instincts in collision. And I did that, and I went home, and I did what it talked about in the 6th and 7th step. And over time, I've realized that if I am not the problem, there is no solution, and there's not going to be. That I have to find out what part I play in life and go from there. And I don't know, you know, in the 6th and 7th step, for a long time, I really kind of didn't understand how God can help you like that. And I started to understand it little by little as I got sober. There was a guy over my house the other day, a couple months ago, and he quoted a line in the book. He said that I always thought that it said that we had to concede to our innermost selves that we were real alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. And he goes, no, it doesn't say that. What it says is we learned that we had to do that. And over a period of time of being in Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned what my problem is. That my problem isn't drugs and alcohol. My problem is what happens to me when I quit drinking. And that I have a physical allergy and an obsession of the mind. And that just doesn't mean for drugs and alcohol. That means for a lot of things. And I didn't know that 6th and 7th step were going to be my saving grace a lot of times. I know there's times in sobriety that I honestly believe that I wasn't going to be able to quit doing the things that I was doing, that they were actually going to kill me. I know there's some of you that smoke tonight. I have no problem with that. I would have kept smoking if I could have kept breathing and smoking too. But I couldn't keep breathing and smoking. So I prayed every day for 5 years to ask God to please help me quit smoking. And one day I woke up and I just quit. And I remember one time I always thought I wish I could be like other people. You know, I watch people sometimes. They drink like a cup of coffee in the morning and that's it. They don't have no more. Now, if I could have done that, I'd have never gave up caffeine. I was drinking Diet Coke from the time I got up till the time I went to bed. A friend of mine and I went to Hawaii. We hand-trucked Diet Coke out to the car. We threw it in the trunk, and about 3 or 4 days, it was all gone. We were riding around with it in a cooler. We were drinking it just like it was Budweiser, you know, one right after another. After a while, after months and months of doing that, I'm like walking around just crazy all the time, and I can't understand what's wrong with me. And eventually, I realized that I got to quit drinking caffeine because it's doing this. And another time in my life, I pray to God, and I ask Him to take this away. There's been actual times throughout my sobriety that I've been so crazy that I honestly believe I'm not going to be able to surrender. It's like I just feel like I'm going to stick a gun in my mouth before I'm able to do that. But I keep doing the same things. I keep going to meetings. I keep trying to help new people. I keep trying to do this, and eventually it goes. It's like some days I wake up, I'm like a cat on a hot tin roof. I can't eat. I can't sleep. I can't watch TV. I can't do anything. I'm just nuts. And then I go to bed, and I wake up the next day, and it's gone. I don't know where it came. I don't know where it went. And I think the very essence of the 6th and 7th step is that when you find no more value in suffering, healing is instantaneous. When I find no more value in what I'm doing, I'll quit doing it. You know, it's like that guy, he says, my brother-in-law's out in the front yard every day acting like a chicken. And they says, well, the psychiatrist says, if you sign these papers, we'll commit him. He goes, oh, we can't do that. He says, why not? He said, how would we live without the eggs? You know, that's been my story my whole life. You know, I don't want to be out there in the front yard, but I don't want to give up the eggs either. And you got to give up something in order to have something. And when I find no more value in what I'm doing, then I'm willing to change or go in another direction or do something different. And I went back and I've tried to make amends to everybody that I could think of. The first people that I went back and made amends to was my family. I remember I made amends to my mother, and I started talking to her, and I says, Mom, you know, I'd really like to have a relationship, a mother and son relationship, and I'd really like to hold up my end of the bargain, and I hope you can forgive me for all the selfish and shameful things that I've done to you, because I was a mean little kid. Before I drank, I was mean. I was mean when I drank. I was mean before I drank. And she says, I can do that. And I sat back on the couch, and she kept looking at me. And I thought, what are you looking at? She looked at me, not with them looks like they used to look at me when I was pitiful, kind of like a dog looks at somebody in curiosity. And I said, well, what's the matter, Mom? She says, you know, it's really nice to talk to you without your head being between your legs. And that's how they used to come down to Skid Row and get me and bring me into the restaurant. And I'd, I'd have mashed potatoes all over me, and I'd just fall in my food. I was a mess. And eventually they quit coming, you know. But I went to her, and I started making amends to my ex-wives, and my son, I started doing things with him and trying to get him, and I tried to do the best I can there. And I remember my first mother and father-in-law, he was a captain of the highway patrol, and I was doing a lot of drugs at the time in a little small town, and he eventually had to leave because he couldn't stand the heat of all the stuff that I was doing. And he left, and I used to sit in A-meetings and hear people say, "Oh, people have probably forgot about you. If you owe too many people, it's just your ego and all that." That's not what it says in the book, but just the same, I was like 100 miles away from where they were. I knew where they were. I was in Wyoming at a roundup, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to call them up, and I'm going to go there. And I went, and I got on the phone, and I called her mother up, and I said, "Hi, Nadine, this is Stan." She goes, "What do you want?" This has been 20 years since I've seen these people. I said, "I don't want anything. I would like to sit down with you and your husband, and I would like to talk about how I can make amends to you for all the selfish and shameful things I've done and all the stuff that I did." She goes, "We never want to see you again." And I talked to her for a little bit longer, and I hung up the phone, and I walked away, and I felt cheated. I felt cheated. I know it's just my ego, but I felt cheated because I wanted them to see me differently than they saw me the last time they saw me. And sometimes you just don't get them privileges. I know that all the time that I grew up in my life, as a child, my dad was a gambler. We lived in not too good a house. I used to be so ashamed of it. And I remember I used to have my friends drop me off two or three blocks away, and I'd walk there. And I remember I always felt like my dad's family, they were always doing the right thing, and a family, and they did everything that way. And I always felt a little intimidated and a little shameful around them, like I never measured up. And I remember about 7 or 8 months ago, my aunt called me up on the phone, and she says that she was coming to Las Vegas from California because her brother died, and she wanted to know if she could stay at our house long enough to take a flight out. And I says, "You know what, you just come and I'll take care of all the arrangements." When she got here, I had everything taken care of. I had the plane taken care of. I had a meal for her. Renee and I made a meal for her. And I went and got my dad so he could talk to her, and we sat down there. And when I took her to the airport, I felt, it's like a million pieces of me are scattered all over the place, and it's like every time something like that happens, a piece of me gets to come back. Because I live in a pretty nice place now. And the hardest amend that I had was been with my father, and he died about 5 months ago. And he did a lot for me. So I always felt like I owed him a lot. And I always strive to try to make amends to him for all the things that I did to him. And I remember one time, I had this idea in my head that I'm going to get him and my son, and we're going to take this nice trip and do some bonding and all that nice stuff. And I go to pick him up that morning, and I take him to the cafe so he can have a cup of coffee. And he goes, "I'm smoking in your car, and if you don't like it, you can take me home." I says, "Well," I got halfway up the road after we got out of there, and I said, "I'll tell you what, Dad, if you want to have a cigarette, I'll pull over to the side of the road. You can smoke all you want. We'll get back in the car and leave." This was the longest trip I ever took to Wyoming. It took forever. Now, my son has never been around his grandfather very much, so he really doesn't know how my dad is or was. So we go into Kentucky Fried Chicken, and we go in there, and we're sitting in there eating, and he gets a cup of coffee, and it's bad. It's old. And I can see that he's going to start making a scene. He used to make a lot of scenes when we were younger, and I knew that. So I just kind of acted like I didn't know him and started walking away from him in another part of Kentucky Fried Chicken. But not my son. My son started following him. So I sat back and watched that, and he goes up to that people at the clerk. He goes, "This coffee's bad." He says, "You can stick this coffee up Colonel Sanders' ass." And Josh looks at him, and he goes, "Not only that, you can stick it up Mrs. Sanders' ass too." Oh. And Josh just kind of looked at me. Later on, we talked about it, but that's the way he was all my life. And I tell you, he was a real hard guy to try to make amends to, and I tried a lot of things. I'd bring him out to the house for supper, and I tried to do a lot of things, and I just could never try to, like I'm getting even with him.
And I'm driving out to the prison one night, and Billy Smith said to me, he says, well, maybe he's never going to let you make amends to him. Maybe he can't. He can never let you be even. And I thought, you know, that's probably true. And we got along pretty good when I was drinking, it seemed like, but we didn't get along very good when we were drunk. And I always had these ideas in my head about how I wanted him and I to be, because I'd hear people come up the podiums and talk about it. I think, God, I'd really like that. You know, I get in this enchanted forest kind of thing, but then there's reality. And I could never get through that. But there's times when there's a lot of people in my family, my sisters, they wouldn't even talk to him anymore. My one sister had nothing to do with him, but I kept striving to do that because I know that I can work through a lot of things that they can't because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when he died, I went down to his house. He was sick all week, and I went down there, and I said, Dad, you want to go to the hospital? And he goes, no. I said, okay. I said, if you do need anything, he says, no. And I left. And the next day I came down and I knocked on his door and I says, Dad, let me take you to the hospital. He goes, no. He said, I think I'm getting better. He said, I've been wrong about most things in my life, but I think I'm getting better. And I says, well, I says, let me take you. He says, no, I'm okay. And one of the very last things he did before he died was he asked me if I needed anything. And I told him no and I left. And a couple days later, my brother called me and told me he had a heart attack working out. He was doing what he liked to do. And at first I thought, well, maybe I didn't get as even with him as I thought. And I look back on it now and I realize that there's probably some things that I couldn't have done, but overall I did a good job. I did the best I could with what people in Alcoholics Anonymous have taught me. And I know that if it wasn't for the steps and doing inventories, it's like the 10th step and stuff like that has become a working part of my mind a lot of times. When I go into a situation or something happens to me, my mind automatically starts thinking, what could I do better here? What should I do here? Should I do this? What could I have said there? Could I have said something else? Maybe I shouldn't have been that way. Maybe I should be this way. And I'm always trying to strive to do better in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I fall short a lot of times. You know, a guy was telling me the other day that Bill Wilson went and talked to somebody, and I can't remember who it was. It was a psychologist or something. And he said, I don't understand. I've been sober all this time, and I still have these feelings of insecurity and not enoughness and coming from behind, and I'm always trying to do better. And he said, I don't understand that. And the guy said to him, he said, well, that's a blessing. He said, God blesses some people like that every now and then. And I guess it is a blessing. I constantly try to do better. I go to 7 to 10 AA meetings a week. I try to practice the principles. I do a lot of things I'm not supposed to do. I believe that I'm the kind of person I could probably walk out of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I believe that I wouldn't even have to pick up another drink in order for me to kill myself stark raving sober. I wouldn't even have to pick up a drink. I'm just the kind of person, I get addicted to anything. Anything that'll make me feel good and take my eyes off myself, hey, you're mine, man. You know, I'll do you till I die. And Alcoholics Anonymous keeps me tethered here enough to where I don't go out and do that stuff. I know that my home group, I belong to the Friday Night Floating Big Book. They believe in a lot of service. We go to a lot of hospitals, institutions. And I just started doing 12-step work right away. But there's more to the 12-step is probably practicing the principles. And I know that a year and a half ago I got married. I remember I used to go to the Thai club meeting at 11 o'clock, and I'd say, I'd tell people I was getting married from the podium, and everybody would clap. She'd go to her Al-Anon meeting and tell them that she was getting married in there, and they'd just stare at her. But I really didn't know how to be married. I mean, it's easy to ask somebody to marry, and it's easy to go through that process. It's kind of like buying a car, you know. It's easy to buy the car, but making the payments gets a little tough sometimes. And I really didn't know how to, I know as much about relationships you could put in a goddamn thimble. And I really didn't know what to do, so I went to Dick. He'd been married a long time. I said, Dick, I don't know what to do. He said, do the same thing you do on your job. He says, you go home and you be of service. And I says, okay. So I started doing that. I started going home being of service, and I realized that I don't do things right, so I don't have to do as many things as I thought I was going to have to do. But I still get credit for trying, so that's the main thing. And I don't know, you know, my life today is better than it's ever been. I just went back and seen my mother, and last time I stayed in her house was right before I got sober. And there, and
The last time I was in her house was on one of my last runs, and I was really sick when I got there. And I went in their medicine cabinet, and I drank a great big old bottle of cough syrup. Man, it was good. I enjoyed that for 2 days while I was there. And I remember this time when I was there, it's the first time I'd been there in the house. Usually I stayed in a motel room, but this time I stayed there. And it's funny how my mind works. I went into the bathroom, and my mind thought, I wonder if there's any still in there. I mean, I can't help but think that way. And I thought, I'm not looking. And I didn't look. And I went back and I did that, and I'm really glad that I'm able to do things like that today. You know, I really would like to thank God and my sponsor and Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't do it without Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no way in this world, and I couldn't do it without a sponsor, and I surely couldn't do it without God. And alcohol took everything out of my life that I loved and cared for. It took more out of my life than a man deserves to lose. And Alcoholics Anonymous has put more back in my life than a man deserves to have. And there's a story, and it came from Keith Drum. He never said it last time, so I'll say it for him. I really like the thing he talked about. He talked about this little boy that lives on this ranch. And this little boy lives on this ranch, and he's seen that the circus was coming to town one day. And he says, Daddy, he says, can I go to the circus? He said, if you work all week long, I will give you enough money to go to the circus next week. That kid worked all week long. He worked as hard as he could all week. Came time for him to go to the circus. His dad gave him the money. He went down to the circus. He walked all the way into town. And the parade was going by. He's never seen a circus before, so he sat down on the curb and he watched the parade go by. And when the last clown came by in the parade, the clown had his hat out. And he says, the little kid took the money that he had and he threw it in the clown's hat and he went home. And he told his dad what had happened. And it's a sad story because he missed the big top. All he seen was a passing parade. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't want to be in the passing parade anymore. I want in the big top. I want it all, man. I want everything that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. I go to 7 to 10 meetings a week, hospital institution meetings. I don't do that because I want to come and tell people or even think that I'm better than anybody else. I do it because I sincerely, in my heart, believe that I am powerless, and I sincerely, in my heart, do not want to go back to where I came from. God, I don't want to ever go back there again. If it takes an hour a day or being committed to Alcoholics Anonymous, if that's what it takes, then that's what I'll do. So deal me into the big top, man. I want it all. I never went into a bar and says, hey, wait a minute. I only want a couple drinks. And I never went into a dope den and says, wait a minute, I only want a little bit. I wanted everything they had and everything I could get in between, and it's the same thing in a bar, and I have no place else to go, and Alcoholics Anonymous is my way of life, and I want it all, and thanks.